Hello again, this is Health and Happiness, presented to you on Monday evenings at 7 Mountain Time and on Thursday mornings. This is Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, along with Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist. We're the co-hosts of the program Health and Happiness, KGVM 95.9 FM, or KGVM.org. We're brought to you in part by the Public Education Committee of the Montana Psychological Association. We deal mainly with mental health issues, but a lot of other very interesting phenomena of Gallatin Valley in Montana and the surrounding areas. We have a very interesting program for you today, and we'll learn about the psychology of a very important creature around us. Now, Suzanne, your introduction.
Good evening. We all know, and we've talked about on this program many times, the value of being outdoors, outside, and in the wilds, in the wilderness, on hikes or walks. So it greatly can increase our health and happiness, except at times it might be a big decrease. If, for instance, we should run into certain creatures in the forest, and I know that's a concern for each of us, that when we're out and about, that we know what to do if we should see a bear, or even worse, if the bear should see us. So what we'd like to do today is address a topic that each of us has some concern about, and we've got someone who can really, I think, help our mental health on this issue. Randy Scarlett is a West Yellowstone worker. He is a wildlife biologist for the West Zone in the Custer Gallatin Forest. And he's here today to give us all the information we need to be as safe as possible and to really enjoy those parts of life that increase health and happiness, the outdoors. Welcome, Randy. We're so happy you could be with us today.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
And so how long have you been working in this field, Randy?
Well, I've been on the Custer Gallatin for 7 years now here in West Yellowstone. But I've been a wildlife biologist for about 23 years.
Great experience there. Well, maybe because I know there will be a lot of folks out in the audience and students considering what they want to do. Tell us a little bit about the training and what being a wildlife biologist encompasses. Tell us a little bit about the training, how you decided that, and let's begin maybe perhaps there.
Okay. Well, I decided at a pretty young age that I wanted to work with wildlife. And that kind of pushed me into the wildlife field. So I went to Oregon State University, got dual degrees in wildlife science and fishery science. But my passion has always been wildlife. I was a fisheries biologist for a few years with the Forest Service prior to moving back into wildlife. But a lot of what I do is managing projects, analyzing effects of projects, mitigating for those effects, and then also educating the public and that sort of thing, especially in relation to like bear education and bear awareness activities, and then other wildlife related subjects, you know, like migratory birds or things like that.
So your college experience was maybe 4 to 5 to 6 years since you did a double major there?
Yeah, it was about 5 years of schooling that I did, and then just a lot of experience in the field. I initially worked with like Oregon State University's wildlife program, and then moved in to work with the Forest Service as a seasonal employee, and carried that through. Decided that the Forest Service was the place that I wanted to be in, and just stuck with it. Primarily worked in Northeast Oregon for a lot of my early career. We did not have grizzly bears there, but we did have, you know, a lot of elk and cavity excavating birds and things like that that I worked on. And, you know, before moving here, I just felt like I needed a change and needed to work with some new species and needed some new challenges.
Well, that's exciting that you could have that experience before you even began your full-time work. And would you recommend to young people then going into the field to do like you did, get a summer job with the Forest Service or anything related?
I would. I mean, there's nothing better than getting paid to be out in the field all summer, you know, chalking fish or doing surveys for, you know, lynx habitat or other wildlife species. It's a pretty cool situation that you can do that and get paid fairly well to do it.
That is marvelous. Thank you for sharing with us. And I have one more question related to that. Are there many jobs available? Some fields, it's kind of limited. Others, you're immediately swept up in the need for more workers.
Yeah, there's a fair number of jobs available in the fisheries and wildlife fields in the Forest Service. It depends on where you're at. You know, like the Pacific Northwest, where I came from, Oregon and Washington, there were a lot of fisheries jobs and lesser amounts of wildlife jobs. But here in Region 1 of the Forest Service, there's a fairly robust wildlife program on most forests where you do have wildlife seasonals in the summer.
I suppose that would hold true for places like Utah, where there's Zion National Park, and even desert-like places that there are different species there that wildlife biologists would be addressing.
Right, and there's other opportunities with other agencies like the Bureau of Land Management or the Park Service and, you know, in the wildlife field as well.
Uh-huh. Well, great. Well, we'd like to jump right into, I take it this is high bear season right now, and maybe talk to folks out there about what to know to keep safe when you're going out into the wilderness, the forest, on a hike.
Yeah, you kind of got to remember bears, they're all about breeding and passing on their genes. So they're trying to get enough food to survive the winter, to feed their young, and, you know, to make sure that they grow up and pass on their genes. So they do a lot of moving in the Yellowstone ecosystem. You know, they have kind of their home range where they spend most of their time, but they move a lot across the landscape as food availability changes through the seasons. So I like to kind of remind people of that, you know, basically bears can be anywhere, anytime, because they do move so much and take advantage of the green up as it happens in the spring and then other food sources as they become available through the non-denning season, you know, the summer season. They're super curious. They have really good memories. So anything that they deem could be a food source, anything that smells interesting, they're going to check it out because they are always looking for the most calories for the least amount of effort. That's kind of how their brain works. They want to get as much fat on their bodies and expend the least amount of energy to do it. So that's where they can get into conflict with people, just because they do have that curiosity, a really good memory, and are always moving across the landscape trying to maximize calories. And that's where, like, attractants come into play. When I say attractants, that's basically all of the smelly stuff that people tend to have around them. That's food, beverages, you know, sealed food and beverages as well, garbage, toiletries, lotions, all of that stuff that a bear could perceive as maybe a food source. That's where we do a lot of our work in the Forest Service here on the Custer Gallatin is, you know, teaching people and reminding them that those things can result in, if a bear gets a hold of those and gets a food reward, they can result in some pretty serious conflict. Because bears have such good memories, they remember kind of the action that they took to get that food reward. And, you know, in human food is usually really high in calories, and it can be pretty easy if somebody leaves a cooler out all day and a bear happens to smell it and come in and find it. So bears' minds, the way they work, they remember that action. They will, if they get a food reward out of like a cooler or a garbage can, from that point on, they will associate that, just any cooler, any garbage can, with that food reward, and they'll check it out. So even if it's a completely empty garbage can with nothing in it or it's never had anything in it, or a completely empty new cooler, they'll come over and check it out because there's just a switch in their brain that's been flipped at that point. They're going to look for a food reward in that item. So we really want to prevent that from happening, because typically if that does happen, that bear never forgets that and typically has to be removed from the population, unfortunately. So, yeah.
So it's really not fair to the bears if we're too relaxed or too incautious about food things that we carry or that we use on our campsite. So, because that means not only are we at risk from the bear, but the bear then has to be taken away from the forest. Yeah,
right. That's where the issue comes up. You know, that bear is removed, or it gets into conflict, and results in, you know, conflict either on Forest Service land with other campers or on adjacent private lands. It just bleeds over when something does happen. And, you know, a good example I have is when we had an incident a couple of years ago in one of our campgrounds, Rainbow Point Campground, where a bear got a food reward adjacent to the campground one night. The next day, it was a grizzly bear. It showed up in the campground and was walking around sort of investigating things in the campground. We eventually shooed the bear out of the campground that day, you know, warned everyone not to sleep in tents that night, to put away all their attractants, things like that. The bear did come back that night, got several food rewards in the back of people's trucks that, you know, the people just did not store their attractants properly. The bear also got into a tent. Luckily, there was no one in it. But it just snowballed very fast. That bear got a food reward, and immediately it was just in the campground and looking for more stuff and got into conflict. It actually turned out, you know, it wasn't a horrible outcome. That bear was trapped the next day. So all this in the span of about 2 or 3 days. And it was moved to the Grizzly and Wolf Discovery Center. But normally that bear would have to be euthanized and removed from the population.
And there was such a sad story along these lines, maybe a couple of weeks ago, about a baby bear that had fallen into a rapidly moving stream and was unable to get back out, and a friendly person hiking in that area saw the baby bear and jumped in the water and saved the baby bear. But that meant now that the mother wouldn't take the baby back, if I understood the article correctly. And so that bear had to be put down. Is that typical of what might happen, Randy?
With bears, I don't remember that situation, but with bears, any time there's cubs involved, because bears spend so much time taking care of their cubs. You know, grizzly bears, they'll have their cubs with them for 2 or 3 years. So they invest a lot of time. And it may take up to 8 or 10 years for a female to even replace herself in the population. If cubs are involved, it's very likely that a bear is going to get very confrontational. And, you know, a lot of the encounters we have on the forest in the greater Yellowstone are related to cubs, carcasses on the landscape, different food sources, and then just surprise encounters. So that gentleman, if that was the case, that gentleman was pretty lucky that the bear didn't confront him if he was messing with the bear cub.
And understood he got a fine. Even though he was trying to do a good thing, it ended up not being good. And it was a very teaching moment for me to think, no matter what, you really shouldn't interfere.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And, you know, on this forest, we have what we call a food storage order. It's an actual federal regulation that says what people need to do with attractants and other things that bears might be attracted to while they're recreating in the forest. And it lays out what people need to do, how to store those items, you know, whether it's hanging in a tree in backcountry settings where, you know, you have to hang it at least 10 feet high and at least 4 feet from side trees, or in front country settings where, you know, you need to store everything inside bear-resistant food boxes, certified containers like that. other certified bear resistant containers, like some coolers, as long as they're locked and bolted. Or, you know, the simplest thing people can do to meet that food storage order is just keep all of their attractants in their vehicle in a hard sided like camper. As long as all the windows are rolled up, a bear generally isn't going to be able to get into that. That's considered appropriate storage.
So do you have to go to a specialty store to find these containers? How would people out there go and find containers if they decided they wanted to go and cook out and spend the night out camping out? Where do you get those?
Well, I mean, there's a couple things you can do. Like I said, the simplest thing you can do is just keep all of your attractants inside your vehicle, a hard-sided vehicle with the windows closed. But if you're interested in certified bear-resistant products, you can go online onto the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee website, which is, I believe it's, I'd have to check the website, but they have a list of bear-resistant certified products, and that includes coolers and dumpsters and garbage cans. And, you know, it's like 40 or 50 pages of certified items. You can actually look up whether the product you have is certified, or the product you're looking at the store is certified. You can also look on the product at a store, and it will have a little seal on it. When products are certified bear-resistant by the IGBC, they get like a little sticker on them that says as much to ensure, you know, consumers that that product is bear resistant.
Well, I've understood that bears have a very keen sense of smell, even from a distance. And so I was wondering, I'm visualizing a campfire where you roasted some food. And you ate, and so you yourself retained that, some of that smoky bacon, steak, whatever flavor. And we all know, you know, that you still kind of reek of what you cooked and handled and ate. Is that enough of a smell to attract a bear? And in that case, how do you prevent just normal cooking smells and the campfire and then your clothing that's permeated afterward? Is that a problem, or am I being too concerned here?
No, that's not too much concern. I mean, bears have really great noses. They can smell a carcass from 10 or 15 miles away. And their sense of smell is, I think, about 7 times better than a domestic dog. So they can smell a lot of things. What we really want to prevent is them getting a food reward. But in backcountry situations, you know, the clothes that you're cooking in, just like you mentioned, they can absorb smells from your food. So we recommend that people store their clothing that they cooked in along with all of their food in an appropriate manner in backcountry settings. So most backcountry settings, that's hanging your food in a bear hang. And we recommend at least 100 yards from your campsite, so that if a bear does smell that stuff, they go to that bear hang, they can smell it, they can't access it, and it's away from your tent, away from where you are, so that they don't stumble into something else. The other thing you need to think about with like backcountry camping is just not keeping any sort of scented items, attractants in your tent, especially at night. If you have those items, a bear may smell those and may try to investigate them, which would be a bad situation. We recommend, you know, when you're sleeping in your tent backcountry, you've got your bear spray and you've got a bottle of water. Otherwise, you don't want to have granola bars or your toothpaste or any of that other stuff in there with you.
Wow, yum. Mm. So you're saying nighttime is more significant for bears? Like, I read one article that said dawn and dusk are highly active times for bears, too.
Bears tend to be most active dawn, dusk, and at night. I mean, females that are feeding cubs will be more active throughout the day. But nighttime, they're moving around a lot more. The other thing is, if you're in your tent sleeping, you're not, you know, you're not attending your attractants. That's the main thing, is we don't want to leave things unattended. If you're asleep and not coherent, you're not attending that stuff. Typically, if you're in like a campground situation, if you're within 100 feet of your attractants and you have a clear line of sight of them, you're generally okay. And that meets our food storage order if you meet those requirements.
Tell us about bear spray. We hear about it that you're to use. What exactly is it, and what is the proper way to use it?
Yeah, bear spray, it's basically hot pepper oil, capsaicin oil, made from hot peppers. It's if you've ever had it on you, you'll know that it's not very pleasant. Bear spray is made so that it's not like the stuff that's made for humans that comes out in a small stream that you shoot at a person's eyes. Bear spray is made so that it, when you fire it, the nozzle system and the propellant actually create a big cloud of this hot pepper oil that shoots out at about 70 miles an hour. It's designed so that it kind of expands and rises up, creates a wall between you and a bear that might have chosen to charge, to move towards you, or that gets within the range of the spray. When the bear gets that stuff in its eyes, in its nose, down its throat, it sort of forgets that you were ever maybe a threat. You know, say you've gotten too close to its cubs or a food source or within its personal space. They completely forget that you were the threat and just are feeling pain, a temporary effect of pain for 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and they want to be somewhere else. And that's kind of the idea behind bear spray and how it works. It is quite effective at changing bears' behaviors based on research that's been done. It's about 92% effective at changing a bear's behavior when it's used on a bear.
If one gets it on yourself or another, what do you do? How do you get it off?
Yeah, so it is oil-based, so just washing it with water will just tend to spread it. So you want to get some soap and some water, kind of emulsify that oil so that it can actually break down and you can get it off of your skin. But that's the best thing you can do. When I'm out hiking or hunting and I've got my bear spray, I carry a small bar of soap with me so that if I do happen to either accidentally shoot myself bear spray or have to deploy it on a bear, I have the ability to clean it up so that I'm a little more comfortable.
And I'm assuming you use fragrance-free soap.
Yeah, as best you can. So that's the thing. People kind of think, well, what if I have granola bars and soap and stuff in my pack when I'm hiking around? Generally, that's not an issue. A bear might smell that, but you know, if you're doing all the other things that you need to be doing out in the woods, you know, recreating, like making noise, hiking in groups, you know, being aware of your surroundings, that sort of thing, a bear is going to recognize that you're a person and they're generally not going to want to be near you. Most of the times, if you get anywhere near a bear out in the woods, they are going to run away and you're never even going to realize they're there. So if you have that smelly stuff in your pack, as long as you're making noise and doing what you are supposed to be doing out in the woods, you don't have to really worry about that stuff. Now, if you were to, say, set your pack down on a trail and then hike off to a river to take a swim for an hour or so and left that stuff in it unattended, that's another situation. That's a, you know, kind of a different situation where a bear could come in and investigate that because they haven't recognized that as, you know, a person being there.
I had another question about bear spray. So a person buys it and they put it in the cupboard for those times when they might go out, and it sits there a while. Does it get old, or can you use it the following season or two? Is there a shelf life for bear spray?
Yeah, there is a shelf life on bear spray, and all the manufacturers, you know, they're all EPA certified as bear spray, number one, and then they'll all have an expiration date. The red pepper oil, the capsaicin, doesn't expire, it doesn't go bad. But what happens over time is the O-rings within the can itself start to deteriorate and shrink, and it allows the propellant to escape. So once you get past that expiration date, those O-rings get smaller and smaller, more propellant escapes, you know, and it will not come out as fast or as much as it would with a fresh can that's not expired. So we tell people, you know, if you have an expired can, you do not want to rely on that can just because of that. It's not going to be, you know, as big a cloud, or you won't have as much spray time in the can. So, yeah, always look for that date. Here at the Forest Service, we're kind of tough on our bear spray cans when we're out working, you know, with our trail crews or whatever. The expiration date a lot of times will rub off of the can. We always write the expiration date on the very bottom of the can where it can't rub off. You know, if it's on the side of the can where the manufacturer puts it, a lot of times it'll come off. But just write it on the bottom of the can so you're sure. That way you don't get down the road and have an expired can and aren't able to recognize that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, otherwise you end up just maybe throwing a can at the bear. Not effective.
What types of... Go ahead.
Yeah. So, you know, like I mentioned about just people recreating out in the woods, the best thing you can do is just let bears know that you're there. And the way to do that is to just make noise. You know, yell, "Hey, bear," clap, do that sort of thing, talking back and forth really loud. You just have to kind of think about the situation and your surroundings and where you are. If you're along a really fast moving river and it's very loud, or if the wind is blowing really hard, the noise you're making isn't going to project as far. So you kind of have to think, okay, maybe I need to be louder. I need to yell more often. Because what you're trying to do in those situations is you're trying to let a bear know that there's a person on the trail or in the area and give them a chance to leave the area. Most of the encounters we have on this forest are surprise encounters. You know, bears, they're trying to use the landscape. They want to expend the fewest number of calories they can to move around and get food. So they're using the trail system. They're using roads just because it's easier to move along those. And we have, you know, a lot of people, a lot of users, especially in the summer, that are using those same trails and roads. And people just come into contact and have close encounter contacts. And when bears are surprised, they can become defensive. So just make a lot of noise. Traveling in groups, generally three or more people is best. You just look more imposing if there's more people. Bears kind of go through a calculation in their head where they try to figure out if, okay, this is a threat. You know, this person's too close to me or too close to my cubs. If they're big, you know, you've got a big group of people together, they're going to think, okay, I might get injured if I engage with this bunch of people. I'm going to take off for now and come back to my carcass or whatever later on. So just think about that too, traveling in groups. And then just being aware of your surroundings out in the woods. A lot of our other encounters we have are carcass related, either in the spring when bears are first waking up, or in the fall during the hunting season, starting with archery season. If you smell something dead, you see a lot of ravens or other scavenger birds, things like that, just know that there could be something dead, could be a bear on it. Maybe you want to go somewhere else for the day. So just be super aware, look for tracks, scat, that sort of thing.
Wow, of course. And I just was thinking, as you were talking about making noise, say you're camping and you're in your tent and it's night and you hear a bear prowling around, how about those portable megaphones that you can carry that make sound very loud, and they actually can do like a siren or a beep or a loud voice? Would that be a good item to pack in with your camping gear?
I haven't seen any research on the use of those. We generally say that the human voice is the best thing. You know, if a critter can recognize that it's a person.
The regular, like, human voice. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I get questions about bear bells, and those do make noise, but they kind of get lost in the background noise when you're out hiking. It, you know, kind of sounds like birds chirping sometimes. So I still tell people the human voice is the best thing. Mm-hmm. You know, yelp out, "Hey, bear," that sort of thing is the best thing.
Okay, well, Now we are going to go to the scenario of you have done all of the things you're supposed to, but you're still confronted with a bear. And you're looking at the bear. How far away do you employ your bear spray? What do you do if he's coming toward you, or if you see him and he doesn't see you, and vice versa? How do we handle an actual bear encounter?
Yeah. So if you see a bear and you're out hiking or recreating, we basically tell people the bear's behavior is what determines what you do. First and foremost, if you see a bear and the bear doesn't see you and is just doing its business out in the meadow eating or whatever, don't bring a bunch of attention to yourself. Don't yell or wave your hands. If you do that to a bear that's kind of unsuspecting and you surprise it, that could actually be a threat to that bear. That's how they could perceive that. So if you see a bear, it doesn't see you, you can just move off back the way you came. You can decide if you need to keep going the way you're going, whether you need to take a route around that bear downwind and get around it. But just don't do anything that would threaten that bear. It's a little different situation when you see a bear and the bear sees you. You know, they're trying to figure out what you are. They might stand up on their back legs. They might just kind of eyeball you. But the main thing is when you and a bear are kind of sizing each other up is don't ever run. That can trigger a predatory response where they actually chase you. And you want to stand your ground and not get any closer to the bear. You know, some people are tempted to get closer to take a picture. Don't do that. But you also don't want to necessarily back up. Sometimes that can be kind of an invitation for a bear to move towards you because they're trying to figure out what you are. They might actually move closer to you to try to get a better look. So don't run, stand your ground, see what the bear does. There's a couple scenarios. Most of the time, once a bear realizes you're a person, they're going to run off. They'll want to be somewhere else. The other scenario is that a bear could become defensive. You know, if there's cubs involved, like a sow with the cubs, or there's a food source there that the bear is defending, or if you're just too close to the bear, you've surprised it, you're kind of in its personal bubble, it could get defensive. And when I say defensive, most people kind of equate that with aggressive. They'll start to make noise, they'll moan, they'll pop their teeth, they'll drool, they'll swat at the ground, they'll shake their heads, all that sort of stuff. Those are indicative of a bear being, you know, defensive. They're perceiving you as a threat. When that happens, that's where your bear spray comes into play. You need to have it accessible somewhere close by, you know, on your hip or on a chest holster. I see a lot of people hiking that have it in their backpack in the back. With how fast encounters happen sometimes, that half a second or a second that it takes to get that bear spray out of your pack, that means a lot. So if you've got it accessible on your hip or on a chest holster and can get to it fast, that's way better than if it's in a backpack. So it definitely needs to be accessible. If a bear does charge, they are running about 30, 35 miles an hour, so they cover a lot of ground fast. With bear spray, you're kind of creating a cloud in front of the bear that they have to hit and that they'll react to, and then they'll generally run off. So bear spray, depending on the manufacturer, it'll spray anywhere from 25, 35 feet, maybe a little further. So when I'm teaching people how to use bear spray, I tell them, you want to spray, if you have a bear that is charging you, you want to spray when that bear is further out than the effective distance of your spray. So I tell people, like a school bus length, maybe even a little bit further, that's about when you want to spray at the bear. And you want to spray down towards the ground in front of the bear. You don't want to spray at his head because they're moving so fast. And when that spray comes out, it comes out and it rises and expands. So if you aim at their head at, you know, say they're at 50 or 60 feet, it's going to go right over the top of them. You want to be spraying at the ground in front of them so that it hits the ground and it billows up and kind of creates that wall. Yeah.
That's very helpful. And I think these are things most of us wouldn't necessarily know. We've no part of it, but I think you're giving us the whole picture here, Randy. Thank you very much. And
by the way, what types of bears are there in this region?
Yeah, we've got grizzly bears and black bears, and quite a few of both. There's some ways you can tell them apart. But like I said, if you're responding to an encounter, the bear species does not matter. It's the behavior of the bear that determines how you react to it. But, you know, black bears, grizzly bears, there's a lot of overlap in size, a lot of overlap in color. So those aren't good ways to tell them apart. But you can look for the shoulder hump on a grizzly bear. That's a pretty indicative of a grizzly bear. They're always going to show a shoulder hump, which is a muscle group in their front shoulders because they do a lot of digging. It's just a really developed muscle group. You can also look for the short rounded ears. Their facial profile is kind of a dished facial profile. Whereas a black bear, there's kind of a straight line from their forehead down their nose. Grizzly bears, there's a break in the middle. It's pretty clear when you see it. But that's just some ways you can tell them apart.
I read recently that Montana is the state with the most grizzly and black bears of any other state other than Alaska way up north.
Yeah, when you look at it, we've got the Yellowstone ecosystem here, which is partially in Montana, and the bear population associated with that. And then we've also got Glacier up in the northwest Montana. And I can't remember offhand how many bears are in that population, grizzly bears, but there's quite a number. And then we do have a robust black bear population as well.
Mm-hmm. What other animals should one be leery of other than bear?
Well, I would say the one where I've run into the most encounters, you know, public coming in and talking to me is moose. In the spring, cow moose have their calves, and they're pretty protective of those calves. So we have had people actually spray moose with bear spray down here. But it'll work on any animal that's getting in your personal space. I know it'll also work on cougars and that sort of thing as well.
What about wolves, foxes, mountain sheep?
I haven't heard of any instances of people using bear spray on wolves or foxes. Foxes have a tendency to get habituated to people, especially around human developments like West Yellowstone here. And mountain goats, similar thing with them. They can get used to people and sort of habituated, especially along like trails, like in the Bridgers, for instance. People can get very close to those mountain goats, but they're still wild animals. They just are using the same habitat, and mountain goats tend to be sodium limited. Their environments are sodium limited, so they will actually lick urine from humans off of trails or adjacent to trails. That's one of the reasons they're so close to trails. It's best if you can keep your distance from those animals, but I have not heard of an instance of somebody using bear spray on one. It's just a matter of needing to keep some distance.
Are there any rare species in this area?
Yeah, I mean, we've got wolverine in this area. They're fairly low densities, but we do have them in our higher elevation areas. They're typically associated with subalpine and alpine areas with reliable snowpack into the late spring where they actually den up. We also have a few lynx around, and not sure if we necessarily have a breeding population of lynx, but we do have individuals that are present from time to time. We've also had individuals from the reintroduced population in Colorado that have passed through this area in the past. So they have utilized this area. It's just hard to get a handle on how many we have right now. We do surveys on Forest Service land during the winter, snow tracking surveys and that sort of thing to try to find those rare species. and see where we actually have them distributed.
This is all so interesting and so necessary. I was wondering, when you hear a story like the one I heard just before moving to Montana, it came on the morning news. I was in Texas, and it said, this morning in the high school in Bozeman, Montana, a bear came in the high school building. And I almost drove off the road because I happened to have two grandchildren in that particular high school on that particular morning. And so what's going on? And we know it's sad for the bear when they come into town. And last summer, there were signs on trails right downtown that said, don't take this trail because there's been a bear sighted here. So what about when bears decide they want to come into our territory?
Yeah, so a lot of that happened in the fall. Bears, when they're getting ready for winter, they go into this period where all they're thinking about is eating. It's called the hyperphagic period. They will eat for 20 hours a day and put on, you know, 20,000 calories. They're just all about eating. So with respect to Bozeman, there are a lot of black bears in the Bridgers and the surrounding areas. And a lot of those conflicts are associated with black bears. They tend to be more comfortable around human developments. Grizzly bears generally want to avoid humans. They do a lot better and survive better where in areas that are more distant from human developments and roads. But black bears, they can become habituated. If they get a food reward, they tend to stick around human developments. One thing about Bozeman, you know, there's a lot of smells there. Bears are looking for food in the fall. There's a lot of fruit trees in Bozeman. The bears move out of the hills because those fruit trees and some of that easy stuff that they can get hold of around human developments is, you know, the highest calorie stuff that they can find at that point in time. So that's where we have bears really moving into town and sort of investigating things. It's all about, you know, like fruit trees, need to pick the fruit off those trees, get rid of it. That'll take away that kind of temptation for bears to come down to your property and investigate things. So that, you know, if that doesn't happen, then they don't find other things that might be laying out, you know, a chicken coop or a beehive, you know, that sort of thing. We're just trying to prevent all of that kind of cascading effect from happening.
And that probably is the same reason that last spring we were going over by Target and behind Ross, and there was a large moose calmly eating the vegetation right there in the center of town, right in the midst of the parking lots. We couldn't bring ourselves to drive away. We sat at a distance in the car and watched. And in this case, they sedated the moose, and it took about, what, 6 or 8 people to lift him up onto a trailer, and they carried him to a safe place in some faraway forest. So that baby bear who came in Bozeman High School, would that baby have been able to be saved, possibly, taken out into the wilderness again? It might have been a teenage baby.
Yeah, it depends on the situation. Typically, a habituated bear can be rehabilitated. It's where bears get food rewards and become food conditioned. They sort of start to associate human developments and people with food, high-calorie, easy stuff. Sure. That it's much harder to rehabilitate a food-conditioned bear. If you move them to another area, typically they're going to keep doing that behavior in the new area. So it just kind of kicks the can down the road.
Yeah.
a lot of times food conditioned bears have to be euthanized or removed.
Because it might put others at risk if we move them there.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's the same thing with black bears and grizzly bears with that respect. You know, sometimes management agencies, when they're trying to catch a problem bear, they'll catch other bears that aren't the target bear. Those bears can be moved, and they might be moved around the ecosystem just to provide them a different spot to be. But food conditioned bears, it's not a good idea to move those around, because it's just going to create a problem somewhere else. One other thing to think about, like you're talking about Bozeman and all the animals in and around Bozeman. People like to be where the animals like to be. A lot of our developments, like Bozeman itself, is right in the middle of a big valley that's, you know, would have been winter range back in the day, but now it's full of houses and developments and things like that. So it's sort of like a coexistence thing. We got to be cognizant that those animals really want to be there. So sometimes we're going to end up with moose right in your backyard or elk or whatever else.
How do bears get along with each other? Is there like an alpha male that dominates the range, or how do they deal with each other?
Bears, there's a fair amount of overlap with home ranges. You know, females will overlap. Males will even overlap. It's when it's during breeding season and when food is limited that you'll have conflict between bears that either have overlapping home ranges or home ranges that butt up against each other. But otherwise they tend to tolerate each other if there's sufficient food and other resources for them to take advantage of.
In thinking about a bear coming to attack a person, one source I read said that rather than standing up and facing the bear, they recommended you lie face down and cover your neck and head as much as you can. I mean, is that a good idea? Tell us more about that if you could, Randy.
Yeah, that's not necessarily the best idea. What we teach is, you know, you need to base your response to the bear off the bear's behavior. So if they're being aggressive, you need to be very calm, you know, not run, stand your ground. If need be, spray the bear. If an aggressive, like defensive bear gets through the bear spray, that's the only time that you would want to assume that position where you lay on the ground on your belly, you know, spread your legs about shoulder width apart and cover up the back of your neck and head. If you have a pack, you can kind of pull it up over the back of your head and neck. But really with a defensive bear that's perceived you as a threat, that is the best thing to do if they get through the spray and are about to get on you or are contacting you, because they're not trying to necessarily kill you by any means. They're trying to neutralize what they perceive as a threat. So if you take that position, you're quiet and you kind of ride it out, which is hard for people to hear. But if you just ride it out, be as quiet as you can and let the bear move off and give them enough time to move off, because a lot of times they'll maul someone, they'll move off to the tree line and just watch that individual and make sure that they've neutralized that threat. If you jump back up right away, they're going to come back and do the same thing again because that threat hasn't been neutralized. So you just need to give it a lot more time. So that's with a defensive bear that's very unhappy that you're near them. You want to be very calm. The flip side of that is if you run into a bear that is very, very calm, focused on you, is like moving towards you, or even like stalking you or moving around you, but it's not showing any of those aggressive behaviors, you know, not making noise, not drooling, not growling, not swatting the ground, things like that. But the bear is very, very calm. That bear may have received a food reward at some point. It's kind of sizing you up like this person might have something I want. With calm bears, you want to be aggressive. You throw things, you yell at the bear, you try to scare it off. And if that bear makes it through your spray, you need to fight that bear. So it's you kind of think of it like you do the opposite of the bear. So if the bear is very aggressive, you're very, very calm. if the bear is very calm, you're very aggressive. So kind of think about it like that.
So do you punch him in the nose or claw his eyes out? How do you fight a bear?
If you have a very calm bear, kind of a predatory bear that thinks you might have something it wants, you got to do whatever you can. You poke it in the eyes, poke it in the nose. If you have any sort of a weapon, you can use that.
Reach for a rock.
That perceiving that you may have something it wants. If you were to lay down with that very calm predatory bear, it would just make its job easier. You would just say like, "Oh, here's a meal then." So that's why you want to fight that bear back.
Okay. Wow. We wanted to ask also a little bit on a different topic. We were riding through a foresty area last summer, and we came across what we think might be quite a rare sighting. It was a black fox.
Yeah, we do have different color phases of foxes. We've got, you know, red fox. We also have like a cross fox that's kind of a mix between red and black. And then we also do have kind of that darker black-gray phase as well. So they are out there, and people see them occasionally. I occasionally get some pictures of some.
So they're not that rare, but...
They're more rare than the full red phase, but they are around. You just don't see them a whole lot.
He was a beautiful little guy. However, I was glad that we were in the car.
Yeah.
Well, we really appreciate you sharing with us. And for those who want to go over all of this material again, we're wondering if you could perhaps share your website again and information about how to reach out if someone out there is wanting more information.
Yeah, so there's a couple places people can go. There's the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee website, which is igbconline.org. There's a lot of information on there about Bear Aware, being Bear Aware. There's also that certified products list where you can go to look and find certified bear resistant products. And then there's also our Custer Gallatin National Forest website, which is www.fs.usda.gov/Custer Gallatin. On there, we're actually redoing a lot of our Bear Aware messaging on that website. So it's going to look a little different here shortly, but we're still in the process of updating that. There is some good information on there, but it's going to be better here fairly shortly.
Well, thank you for sharing that yet again. And you mentioned earlier when we first came on the air that you'd been involved in some projects in your work there. Could you perhaps share with us what those projects were about?
Yeah, so we get involved in a number of projects. Sometimes it's related to fuels projects and things like that. A lot of survey work, looking at lynx habitat, doing raptor surveys, things like that. And then we also do some restoration projects. There's been some projects I've done creating or enhancing habitat for amphibians down here around West Yellowstone, improving aspen stand habitat. Aspen stands in general have been in decline for a number of years. They're getting encroached on by conifers. So we've got in there and taken out some conifers to improve growing conditions for aspen and to get them to regenerate. Closer to Bozeman, we've also done some of that project, some of that sort of work in the Moose Creek drainage and in Porcupine Creek, trying to improve that sort of unique habitat. Aspen is a very diverse habitat type that we don't want to, it covers a very small amount of ground on the forest, and we don't want to see that kind of wink out over time.
Sure.
And then other projects I've done, you know, owl surveys. Those were fun. We did some of those last year in the spring, doing callback surveys at night in bear country. It was an interesting proposition, but it was fun work. So that sort of thing, that's kind of what I'm doing here.
Can I ask a really dumb question? You're talking about surveying bears and birds and fish, etc. How does one go about that? Do you sit by the side of the trail and wait for them to come by? Do you track them with cameras? Or how does one survey wild populations?
It depends on what you're trying to get out of it. I mean, if you're looking for like a presence-absence kind of thing, usually try to find a survey methodology that's been used previously, that's generally accepted. You know, there's good protocols for how to do that, and then you implement it. So, for instance, like the owl surveys, we worked with FWP, Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, last year. And they had some data gaps in their data, you know, for great gray owls and other owls. So they had a protocol. We had the time and the employees to help them out and go do those surveys. But some of that was callback surveys where you're actually projecting different owl calls at night to try to elicit a response from different species of owls. Uh-huh. And then it's some more passive monitoring where we actually had automatic recording units. So we actually set up a recording unit with speakers that would just record all of the calls around that survey point for a number of days, you know, it was 5-6 days, whatever. And then you'd take down that automatic recording unit. You have to work up the data, try to filter it down, and then identify if you have any of the target species calls on that. But that's more of a passive.
That's interesting, though, how you went about that. I was curious. We've had an unusual thing in our experience just in the last week. We've been hearing bobwhites, which typically are in the south where we grew up, but we have them in our yard talking to us this week. Have you heard the bobwhites?
I have not. We've been out doing some grouse surveys down here at the end of the month, end of May. But I don't think around West Yellowstone we have any quail. It's just a little too harsh of an environment down here. But around Bozeman, it's probably amenable to those types of species.
Well, the bird person next door was saying he'd never known them to be here. So we were just curious, just an outlier perhaps, yeah.
Perhaps range expansion or someone has moved some critters around.
We have about a minute or minute and a half. Tell me a little bit about climate change. How does it affect your work?
Well, climate change, in the long term, it's going to reduce snowpack around here. So some of our mountain ranges are going to have, you know, less snow, a shorter period of time where snow is present. So that could affect, you know, for instance, wolverine and where they are able to persist. You know, if they don't have persistent snow through the late spring and early summer, it may not provide good denning habitat for them anymore. Also, climate change might change timing of when plants grow. Things could come on earlier or their range could expand or contract for different species. So it's going to change what food resources are available for different species. For instance, grizzly bears, they might use the landscape differently in response to these vegetation changes or phenology changes in vegetation. So it's going to be an interesting, we assess that with different projects and we're doing effects analysis and we're trying to figure out how to make that a better analysis.
Well, thank you. Good work.
Well, thank you very much for the program today. We invite everyone to listen on each Monday evening and go to the website, kgvm.org. You can pull up this program among those that we have done in the past and listen to it. It'd be extremely educational. But Gallatin Valley, thank you for people like Randy who does this magnificent work. And we urge you to continue to work on your health and happiness. Thank you.